This is Professor Carlson, and this is our lecture for October 4 in employment law. When we left off, we were discussing the two different hats the employer wears with respect to an ERISA plan when the employer acts as an administrator in managing the plan, deciding benefits, releasing information about the plan. The employer acts as a fiduciary and owes his primary duty to the employer. He must act in the sole interest of the beneficiaries, that is, and not the employer's own interest. The employer can't be selfish as a fiduciary. On the other hand, when the employer is acting as an employer in personnel actions or in creating modifying or terminating the plan, the employer doesn't act as a fiduciary. He does not have to look after the interests of the beneficiary class, and the employer can be selfish. Now, there are still some ERISA limits that apply to an employer when the employer is acting just as an employer. For example, the employer must not discriminate against employees who have exercised their rights under a plan, and the employer must not take steps designed simply to interfere with an employee's attainment of rights under an ERISA plan. Now, in our last class, we saw some examples of various corporate actions that might in fact be designed to interfere with the rights of particular individuals to access their benefits. For example, closing down units of the most expensive employees, or selling assets and leaving the most costly employees behind. Let's move on to our next slide now. This is a brief outline of the Waverly disposal problem. There's a lot that could be said about that problem. I want to point out some of the highlights of this case involving severance pay. We'll jump ahead to the third bullet here, which gets right to the root of Middleton's problem. He is an expensive employee to lay off because severance benefits are based on years of service times salary, or a fraction of salary. Now, Middleton has always done reasonably well in his performance evaluations, but all of a sudden he is evaluated as substandard. And this is important because the employer has a motivation to convert his layoff to something for cause. In other words, not a involuntary layoff without cause. It is in the employer's interest to convert his termination into a for-cause termination. That would either allow the employer to deny him any severance benefits at all, or the employer might now plausibly claim, since you're not entitled to severance pay benefits, you're going to have to sign a release of claims and a covenant not to sue before we're going to give you those benefits. Possibly, this sort of action by an employer implicates both its fiduciary duties and its employer responsibility not to interfere or discriminate, because after all, the employer is now using its management of its plan for its own interest, that is, to obtain releases from the employees. Secondly, insofar as the employer is taking a standard employment action, personnel action against Middleton, it could be argued that it is acting for the purpose of interfering with his right to obtain his severance benefits, and therefore is unlawfully interfering under ERISA. Like I said, there's a lot more that can be said, but for the sake of time, we're going to move on to the next slide, which begins a discussion of discriminatory coverage. Can an employer exclude costly employees in its design of plan coverage? Remember, the decision makers at the corporation want to have benefits, but they'd like to find a way to keep the best benefits for themselves. Let's go to the next slide. Can an employer be choosy? What can an employer do to limit plan participation? This slide lists some of the possibilities. Maybe we will convert some employees to independent contractor status or lease them from another employer. Maybe we will design a plan that applies only to employees in one department but not another, or employees of one classification but not another. Maybe we will cover the health risks that we think that we key executives are most likely to experience while excluding health risks that we're not likely to experience. Maybe if this is a very male-dominated corporation, for example, we don't want to have to pay for pregnancy benefits. And finally, maybe the employer would like to charge more for some participants than for others. Next slide, recap. Why do employers provide benefits at all? This is simply to remind us that benefits are voluntary, but there are plenty of incentives for employers to provide benefits, employee loyalty, the tax breaks particularly enjoyed by upper-level employees, and competition with unions. Now, ERISA has a strategy of leveraging the self-interest of the decision-makers to expand coverage of other employees under benefit plans. And one way that it does this with respect to pensions is with respect to something called the non-discrimination rule. Let's go on to the next slide. Here's a very, very brief and simple explanation of something exceedingly complicated, ERISA non-discrimination rules for pension plan coverage. Now, non-discrimination rules apply only to pension benefits, not to welfare benefits, and this is an important limitation. If the employer provides pension benefits for so-called highly paid employees, the employer must provide some proportionate amount of coverage under a pension for lesser paid employees. Now, as simple as that sounds, the equations and formulas for determining whether or not the employer has complied with this rule are quite complicated, and the formulas do still permit some disparities between what we provide for upper-level employees and what we provide for lower-level employees. Employers have a strong motivation sometimes to circumvent the non-discrimination rules by converting some workers into independent contractors, and if they are independent contractors, then they don't count for purposes of the non-discrimination rule. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, there is no non-discrimination rule for welfare benefits. We do have important health reform laws about to take effect, but remember that even these new laws won't really compel the employer to adopt health care plans. It simply imposes a fine for every worker who is not covered by the employer's plan. Next slide. Other federal laws prohibiting discrimination in employment. A couple slides ago, we talked about the different ways that an employer might want to discriminate against particular types of employees or particular types of conditions, like pregnancy. Now, lots of other laws beyond ERISA have some impact here. And we don't have time to go into much depth about the impact of laws against sex discrimination, age discrimination, and disability discrimination. These topics are left mainly to our course in employment discrimination law, but merely I would like to point out in passing that the rules against sex discrimination prohibit employers from designing health and other welfare plans in ways that tend to cover male conditions but not female conditions. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires an employer to cover pregnancy the same as it covers any similarly disabling condition. And the net impact of that rule is that if we're going to cover anything that might require an employee to take a few days off from work, then the employer is probably going to have to provide a similar coverage for pregnancy in a welfare benefit plan. That means health care, that means disability to the extent that we have disability benefits. And I think that's really all that we need to say about those other discrimination laws. We're going to move on to the next slide now, state laws and ERISA or federal preemption. As you certainly would have learned in constitutional law, whenever Congress passes a federal law, there's a good chance that conflicting or supplementary state laws will be pushed aside and preempted as a result. So let's go on to the next slide, ERISA preempts any state law relating to ERISA benefit plans. ERISA is a very preemptive law. In fact, it is as preemptive, I think, as nearly any federal law that you're likely to find. The preemption proviso of ERISA states that ERISA supersedes any and all state laws insofar as they relate to any covered plan. Now, this means that federal law will push state law aside, and state law simply will not apply or provide any cause of action where ERISA is involved. It also means that there's going to be a good opportunity for a defendant in any action involving ERISA or an ERISA plan to remove the case to a federal court. Now, you'll remember that that's fairly routine. Whenever a case filed in a state court involves a federal law claim or question, the defendant typically can remove the case to a federal court. But ERISA actually takes the principle of removal a step farther for this reason. Ordinarily, a plaintiff who files in the state court can avoid removal by something called the well-pleaded complaint rule. That is to say, if the plaintiff is very careful, he states his complaint as if it is exclusively under state law. He doesn't say a single thing about federal law. In doing so, he limits the defendant's response. The defendant can assert the preemption defense, but the defendant must assert that defense in the state court system. He can't remove the case to a federal court. And that means that if the state courts get the issue wrong, they fail to recognize federal preemption when they should, the remedy for the defendant is to appeal it to higher levels of court in the state system, and then finally to the U.S. Supreme Court. When Congress drafted ERISA, they thought that was not a good way of dealing with the problem of preemption. They wanted cases to get quickly and immediately into the federal courts. They did not want these cases to linger in state courts while state courts decided properly or improperly whether or not the case was really preempted. And so Congress adopted a rule of complete preemption in the case of ERISA. And what this means is that if the defendant can persuade a federal judge that a state lawsuit relates to an ERISA plan, if it's a claim within the scope of ERISA remedy provisions, then a federal court will order the case removed from the state court and then filed in the federal court. That's the doctrine of complete preemption. We don't give state courts the first shot at deciding whether or not the case is preempted. Next slide. Aetna versus Davila is an example of the complete preemption rule at work. It's also an example, perhaps, of a major loophole in ERISA, depending on how you look at things. In Aetna versus Davila, you have a couple of different plaintiffs who sued their employer benefit plans because the plans denied coverage for extended stays in the hospital. The plans took the position that the patients were well enough to go home. Turns out, perhaps, that the patients weren't so well, and they suffered as a result. Next slide. Complete preemption by ERISA, question mark? Well, that's the whole issue in Aetna. Is there a complete preemption in this case? The case starts out as a Texas court tort lawsuit based on a lack of due care in a treatment decision. In this case, that is, again, the denial of certain treatment, the denial of that certain care is due under the plan. Now, the big issue in this case is whether the federal courts could properly remove such claims out of state court into the federal courts. And here's the test that we apply. Is the claim asserted by the plaintiff within the scope of ERISA's enforcement provisions? And the answer is yes. We're talking about a claim that involves our right to benefits under an ERISA plan. That's certainly within the scope of what ERISA provides enforcement for. We might ask, what's the source of the duty on which this lawsuit is based? Well, The only reason that Aetna owes this duty at all is because of the existence of an ERISA plan. And finally, would state law duplicate, supplement, or supplant the ERISA remedies? And the answer is very much so, because ERISA does provide a procedure and a remedy for an employee's claim that the benefit plan has wrongfully denied access to certain benefits. Next slide. Implications for beneficiaries. Well, this means, among other things, that state tort or contract claims with respect to benefit plans are preempted. And that means that ERISA will become the exclusive source of remedies. Well, what are ERISA remedies? They include the amount of the benefit due, that is, the cost of the medical procedure or treatment, injunctive or other equitable relief, such as a court order telling the benefit plan to continue to pay those benefits, but nothing beyond that. This is a major loophole, perhaps, especially if you're a plaintiff's attorney. Think about what this does not include. It does not include damages for pain and suffering suffered by the patient. It doesn't cover damages for emotional distress. There's no punitive damages, even for a bad faith denial of benefits. And there's no compensatory damages if the employee loses income because they become disabled as a result of the insurance company's mismanagement of the claim. The employee will not recover damages for that injury. Okay. So, by the way, I should add, this is a continuing issue under ERISA, both as a matter of interpretation of ERISA by the courts and the prospect for congressional action. It's one reason, too, by the way, why when it comes to things like healthcare reform, you're going to find that as that debate evolves, you may be surprised to see who's on each side of that issue, because frequently when employers look at federal legislation like this, they may find that they come out better under a federal legislation that creates a national plan that limits the sorts of liabilities they might otherwise have faced under a variety of state laws. But that's all we have time to say about that issue in this lecture. We're going to move on to the next chapter now, beginning with workers' compensation. It's a mandatory system of insurance. You should be on that next slide. Now you'll see that red asterisk. The asterisk is for the footnote in most states. And in what state is workers' compensation not mandatory? You guessed it, Texas. In fact, if you can get your hands on this month's ABA journal, the one that reached my desk just Monday of this week, you will see a feature article on the Texas workers' compensation system. It is not a complimentary description of our workers' compensation system. I'll have more to say about that in just a moment. Anyway, let's move on to our next slide now, which begins an overview of the workers' compensation system. New York Central Railroad versus White is, in essence, a description of the basic premise of workers' compensation law around the country, which is a compromise between employers and employees. It trades the idea of no-fault access to injury benefits with limited liability for the employer. And that's a compromise. The employer will have to provide benefits without regard to fault or negligence, and in return, the employer gets limited liability. And the great overarching question in workers' compensation is whether or not this compromise has really worked out well for either side. Next slide. Is a compromise needed? It would do well if you could remember what I presume you learned in tort law, which has to do with the difficulty of proving fault and causation in a lot of personal injury actions. Imagine the difficulty of proving that the employer was negligent in causing any particular accident. And as you think about this, think about the picture on the slide, the worker who hurts his back lifting something very heavy. A number of questions are going to be difficult for the employee. Number one, there may be an issue about causation. Sure, we can see that it would be not unusual for someone to hurt his back lifting a railroad tie like that. On the other hand, as many employers will tell you, we also worry that employees will injure their back at home and then come to work and pretend to have injured their back on the job because they want those workers' compensation benefits. So there may be an issue of causation. There will also be an issue of employer negligence. Could the employer have done something that would have avoided the injury to the employee's back? Next bullet of this slide deals with the problem of inherent risks in doing work. And again, look at our picture lifting heavy objects. As you might well expect, if you do that kind of work all of your life, sooner or later your joints are just going to give out and your back is going to give out. Or at any given moment in time, you could just lift something the wrong way and injure your back. Is it even appropriate to think about this in terms of the fault of either party? Are inherent risks like that the result of any negligence by any particular party, or is it just because of the nature of the work in the business? If it's an inherent risk, the danger is that courts will tell the employee not only was there no negligence on the part of the employer, you accepted this inherent risk when you accepted the job. Third bullet, another problem that employees face under the common law tort system is that fellow employee fault was a bar and not a basis for employer liability. Now, think about this for a moment because it's very peculiar when you compare it with what we learned about third-party liability. If a bystander, a visitor, a third party is injured because of the negligence of any employee, we impute that negligence to the employer. The employer is liable for what the employee does. But going back a couple of centuries ago, the courts adopted the rule that when one employee injures another employee, a fellow employee, it's not the employer's liability unless the employer was itself negligent in some fashion. In other words, imputing the negligence of one employee to the employer just doesn't work when the plaintiff happens to be another employee. And think about all of the accidents that happen at the workplace that if they are anybody's fault, they are the fault of a fellow employee. Fourth bullet, the employee's contributory negligence or assumption of the risk was frequently a bar to the employee's ability to recover. Finally, even if you can prove that the employer was at fault and the employer's fault caused the injury, there has always been the risk of employer insolvency. If the employer has no money and is bankrupt, it's rather pointless to sue. Next slide. The statutory compromise. So here's what we did in workers' compensation law. We create a system of medical care and disability and death benefits for all work-related injuries or illnesses. You'll see I put in parentheses there, health reform effect. There's a long story behind what I mean by that, and we may have to postpone that until we meet on Thursday, but I want you to think about the following as we work our way through these slides. There is a huge motivation for employees to convert each and every injury or illness into something work-related or to treat it as such if they don't have employer-provided medical insurance. And that's because if they're going to get money for hospitalization and disability, they're going to get more from a workers' compensation scheme from their own pockets if they don't have their own health insurance. And that's one of the things that the workers' compensation system has struggled with. It's the fact that a lot of employees lacking any other health insurance will characterize all of their accidents and illnesses as being work-related. We'll say more about that as we go on. Second bullet, the idea that the injury or illness was work-related, that's going to replace the requirement of fault. In other words, what makes an injury or illness compensable under this system is not that anybody was at fault or that anybody was negligent, but rather that the illness or accident was caused by or related to work. Third bullet, the exclusive remedy for such injuries will be the workers' compensation system, and workers' compensation will preclude and bar any common law tort action against the employer. Fourth bullet, we have financial security, because the employer will be required to buy insurance from a separate party, the insurance company, and even if the insurance company goes bankrupt, we've adopted a special financial system to cover for financially insolvent insurance companies. Finally, the theory was that we would provide an efficient claim process that wouldn't involve a lot of litigation. This is where the recent ABA Law Journal article becomes important. It describes how Texas tried to eliminate the involvement of lawyers altogether in the process in order to make it more efficient. And perhaps the result has not been what it was advertised to be. Next slide. Workers' compensation law, is it state or federal law? Well, it's state law for most workers. And that means that we're only going to be able to generalize in this section. We'll say, you know, a few things about Texas law in particular, but remember that the law will change as you cross the state border. ERISA does not preempt state workers' compensation laws, even though they do look like benefit plans. And finally, let me skip down to that last or fourth bullet. There are some federal workers' compensation laws for particular categories of workers, such as railroad, maritime, migrant agricultural, or coal and nuclear energy workers. These employees are covered under special federal schemes. Next slide, the Texas twist. Now, there are a lot of peculiar things about the Texas workers' compensation scheme. The ABA Journal talks about the other side of this. I'm going to dwell on a separate problem unique to Texas, which is our opt-out system. It allows employers to become what we call in Texas non-subscribers. These are employers who have opted out of workers' compensation. They are, in essence, going naked without insurance. And when they opt out of the system, their liability will be based on the ancient common law. That means we apply negligence law rather than work-relatedness, just as we did back in the 1800s. Now, this has severe repercussions for employees, particularly with respect to those inherent risks, like back injuries that may be the result of repeated lifting of heavy objects. It means you don't have any coverage under workers' compensation in Texas, because the employer may have opted out, and it will be very difficult to prove negligence. In fact, state courts in Texas have held over and over again that these inherent risks, back injuries and other injuries that aren't necessarily anybody's fault, at least not the employer's fault, must be borne alone by the employee, even though the employee also didn't do anything wrong. Now, if the employer opts out in Texas, Texas law does make the negligence scheme a little bit more favorable to the employee than was true back in the 1800s. For example, we have eliminated the fellow servant defense, which is to say the employer might still be liable based on a fellow employee's negligence. That negligence can be imputed to the employer. Contributory negligence is no longer a defense, although obviously the employer's whole defense might rest on proof that the accident happened only because of the employee. And finally, there's no assumption of risk as a defense. Still, employers have gotten away with quite a lot in proving simply that they were not negligent in causing an accident that is work-related. Employers who do opt out frequently adopt their own employer-provided accidental injury insurance plans. Note that that is an ERISA plan, and it's another interesting twist that we have in Texas. Remember that workers' compensation insurance is not an ERISA plan. But if the employer has opted out of the Workers' Compensation Act and has bought its own employer-provided accidental insurance, injury insurance plan, that will be an ERISA plan because it's not workers' compensation. And frequently these plans are then combined with an agreement to arbitrate any disputes that the employee might have about work-related injuries. Next slide. The basis for coverage of injury or illness. Remember that the key test is whether or not an accident or injury or illness was work-related. In workers' compensation law, we divide the universe into two types of work-related claims. One is accidental injury. The other is occupational illness. We're going to begin today with the problem of accidental injury. Next slide. Begins our discussion of accidental injury. An accident is defined as a mishap or an unexpected event. Thus, if you're going to claim that you have an injury as a result of a work-related accident, you're going to have to prove an event that was a mishap or an unexpected event. Next slide, workers' accidental injury. Was the accident work-related? When you think about it, the employee ends up having to prove two things. Not only that there was an accident that caused his injury, but also that the accident itself was work-related. Remember that fault of anyone is irrelevant at this point. It might be just one of those accidents that was without anybody's fault. Instead, coverage of the accident and the resulting injury depends on the work-relatedness of the accident. Now, there are two ways of viewing an accident as work-related. First, did it happen in the course of employment? In other words, while the work was going on. Second, did it arise out of a worker's employment? In other words, did work somehow cause the accident? Now, at this stage, I'm sure you're wondering what's the difference between these two, but as we work through the next series of slides, we'll see just how important these two different tests can be. Well, for that matter, take a look at the picture on this slide. You're walking from one building to another of the workplace. It's cold. There's ice on the sidewalk. You slip and you fall. Were you actually working when that happened, or were you on a break? Maybe you were on your way to the cafeteria or on your way to your car after having clocked out. Did it arise out of your job? Did your work somehow cause you to slip on the ice? Now, as you're thinking about that question, remember why it is that an employee and his lawyer might be very anxious to call it a work-related accident. The employee might have no medical insurance. He might have no disability insurance on his own, maybe because the employer doesn't provide for health care. If that's true, there's a strong motivation for the employee to try to strategically categorize the accident as work-related because the only medical insurance he's got is through workers' compensation. Next slide. That brings us to Stillman versus WCB. It's an interesting case because of how strange it is that someone could be killed by eating a peanut butter sandwich. This is the case in which the worker is taking a break. He's at home. He's a driver for a truck that needs a load of water. So while he's stopped for lunch at home, he's put the garden hose in the tank to fill it up with water, and he's gone in the house to eat a sandwich. The sandwich is made out of peanut butter. There's a wasp that has gotten into the peanut butter as his wife was preparing the sandwich. Sadly, when he bites the wasp, he is stung on the tongue. He's allergic to wasp stings, and he asphyxiates. He strangles to death. Next slide. Is this an accident related to work? Well, you see this strategy at work of converting an accident into something work-related. Pennsylvania law is a little bit peculiar. It focuses on one of the two tests that we've described. Was the accident in the course of the worker's employment. So in this particular case, only one of those two tests applied. Was the accident in the course of the worker's employment? Now, in the course of employment includes three dimensions: time, place, and activity. Was it during working time? Was it at the workplace? And was it while work was being done? How did Stillman, or rather his widow, argue that all three dimensions might have been met in this case? Well, it will be her effort at remand to prove that her husband was between working hours. In other words, the day of work had not yet ceased because he was taking just a break between tasks. He happened simply to be at home because it was on the way from one location to the other. Moreover, it looks like she's going to argue that because he was simultaneously filling up the tank with water on the truck, that he was in fact engaged in work even while he was eating the sandwich. Number two, did this accident happen at a workplace? Stillman was what we call a roving employee. He's not fixed at a particular workplace. He goes from workplace to workplace, and wherever he goes to do work, that is his workplace. His workplace also includes wherever he stops to maintain his truck or equipment or to resupply his truck. So again, if he stopped at home in order to fill up his truck with water, he was arguably at a workplace. Number three, was he engaged in work-related activity at the time of the accident? Well, again, this is why the garden hose becomes so important. If he was filling up the truck at the time, then perhaps he was, in fact, engaged in work at the time of his accident. And this is how Stillman, or rather his widow, might qualify for an accidental death benefit. She doesn't have any life insurance, or at least she'd like to get some more, and she's going to do this by proving that it was a work-related accident. That last bullet there, effect of the benefit gap, is just to remind you that a lot of what's going on here is that employees are struggling to get all kinds of benefits by converting accidents and illnesses into something work-related. Next slide. The majority or alternative rule adds a second part of the test. It adds an arising out of test. That includes Texas, by the way. Not only must you show that the accident was in the course of employment, you must also prove that it was an accident arising out of the employment. Now, we can think of the arising out of employment as a rough substitute for proximate cause. In other words, did work cause the accident somehow? Think back to our original illustration of the man who slips on the ice on the sidewalk. Sure, he may have been at work when he slipped, but did work cause the accident? Did work somehow contribute to the risk of that accident? In other words, did it make it more likely that the employee would suffer that accident? And finally, that last bullet illustrates or relates to a kind of risk analysis that some courts use in applying this arising out of employment test. Is the risk or the problem that caused this accident, like ice on the sidewalk, is it a risk that the employer should bear rather than the employee? And this may turn in part on which party has the greater control. You might argue, for example, in the case of ice on the sidewalk, that even though it doesn't seem like slipping on the ice has anything to do with the accounting work that this employee does at his desk when he's sitting in one building and not in the other, still, being at work exposes him to risks of the employer's property. And when it comes to risks that exist or hazards that exist on the employer's property, the employer is not only better able to control these risks, but it should more suitably bear the risk and liability of these hazards, and this will promote a safer workplace by incentivizing the employer to make sure that there's no ice on the sidewalk. In other words, it'll go out and put some salt on the sidewalk. Next slide, Technical Tape versus Industrial Commission deals with the problem of accidents to and from work. If you have an automobile accident on your way to work, can you blame it on your work and collect workers' compensation? Next slide. Begins with an overview of the discussion of the going and coming rule, which is, in a nutshell, that commuting to and from work is not, in fact, related to or in the course of employment. Now, you might argue with this a little bit, because, after all, you can think of getting to work as part of your job, and you can argue that you wouldn't have had that accident but for your employment. After all, you don't go on the freeway in Houston simply because it's fun to drive on the freeway. You're there because of your work. And you can even make the argument that work enhances or elevates the risk of such accidents by requiring you to commute so much. But remember that part of what courts think about when they apply the arising out of aspect of the test is who's better able to bear this risk, or who should bear this risk. And the answer will normally come down to the employee. The employee chooses where to live, he chooses how to get to work, he chooses how to drive, and he's in the best position to buy insurance that's adapted to his particular circumstances. Hence, the going and coming rule says that accidents during commuting are not covered by workers' compensation. There are exceptions for so-called special missions, where the employer has asked you to take a detour or to pick something up along the way to work, perhaps a fellow employee. He's at home and his car is broken down. Will you please go by his home and pick him up and bring him with you to work? That has been deemed to be a special mission that can result in coverage under workers' compensation if you have an accident along the way. Travel between work sites. Remember, Stillman was arguably between work sites when he had his fatal accident, and that made his claim plausibly covered. And there are a series even of homework cases where employees bring work in their car home to finish in their homes, and the employees have sometimes successfully argued that since I was going to be working at home too, my driving to home was work-related, and that claim has sometimes prevailed before very sympathetic judges. But on the whole, the general rule and the starting point for any analysis is going to be the going and coming rule. Let's go now to the next slide, technical tape versus industrial commission. Who was asleep at the wheel? And my point is that it wasn't the employee who was asleep at the wheel. It was really the employer in this case. Effective strict application of the going and coming rule would mean, gee, you had an accident on your way home from work. It's your own problem. It's not a workers' compensation matter. You could point out that it certainly was not in the course of work, because, after all, the employee wasn't working at the time. He'd already clocked out. It was not at the workplace. He was not engaged in work-related activity. He was just going home. But this is a case where a court applies the second test, arising out of the work, and applies it as if it is the conjunctive case, which is to say, if it arises out of the work, it doesn't have to arise or be in the course of work. Let me explain what that means in this case. The work caused the accident. The employee was exposed to toxic chemicals, which caused him to become inebriated. And the work caused him to have this accident. Even though it didn't happen in the course of work, the employer, the court at least, holds that in some cases the arising out of test trumps the in the course of test. And that's probably because the court sees very compelling reasons to make the employer bear this cost. What the employer did in this case was really unconscionable to have placed that employee in a tank filled with toxic chemicals. It should have known what the effect of those chemicals would have been on the employee. Then to send the employee home, even though he was clearly under the influence of these chemicals, that was the equivalent of gross negligence. In fact, I think if anything went wrong here, another party who might have been asleep was the employee's attorney, depending on the law of the jurisdiction, because, as we'll say later on, if you can prove that the employer was grossly negligent, there's the possibility of other tort claims that are not preempted by workers' compensation. But let's go on to the next slide now. Dallas Independent School District versus Porter involves a school district employee who is shot while on the job. He is shot by an angry grandma. Next slide is an overview of the problem of intentional workplace torts. Are they work-related accidents? Well, first of all, remember that workers' compensation law applies to accidents, and you might argue that no intentional tort is really an accident if somebody intended it to happen. And that's one reason for saying that when the employer commits an intentional tort, it's not an accident, and therefore it's not covered by workers' compensation. What's more, the workers' compensation insurance company can disclaim liability for all intentional torts. You can't buy insurance for intentional torts. And happily for the worker, in some cases, this means that the worker can sue the employer in tort. That might be the result that the employee wants if he can get more money in a tort claim. Now, there's a separate problem where the tort, the intentional tort, is by a third party. Obviously, public policy may favor workers' compensation coverage in some cases. Think about the poor convenience store employee or the emergency room worker who is assaulted by either a armed robber or by a patient who's whacked out on drugs and pulls a knife out of their boot and stabs everyone within reach. These are third-party intentional torts. And you would want workers' compensation to cover the injuries of workers who are exposed to those kinds of risks. You might ask, was it in the course of employment? And frequently, the types of third-party intentional torts that we're talking about do happen in the course of employment, especially the convenience worker who is shot on the job in the store during working hours. And you could argue that it arises out of employment because, after all, if you're a convenience store worker, having to work late at night with a cash register full of cash exposes you to the heightened risk of this kind of assault. Still, it's a little bit more complicated than that, as the fourth bullet suggests. The arising out of employment suggests that there might be room for a distinction between personal disputes versus job-related accidents. In other words, a lot might depend on why the person who entered the convenience store and shot you, why did they shoot you? Did they shoot you because they're a common armed robber who only wanted to get money from the store? Or did they shoot you because you won a lot of money from them in last night's poker game and they've come back to have their revenge? That would make it personal rather than job-related. Thus, what we have to conclude is that where a third-party intentional tort is concerned, frequently, workers' compensation will provide benefits, but there might be an argument that the accident wasn't business, it really was personal. Now, everything that I've just said might already have been suggested by the whole idea of work-relatedness. Was the assault personal because of something I did at home or in my other business? Or was it just part of the usual sort of risk of being a convenience store worker? Most states have confirmed what I've said by a specific statute which codifies this distinction between personal disputes and those that are related to employment. And here's what they say. The second bullet begins with employer intentional torts. If the employer committed the intentional tort, it's not a covered accident, and a tort suit is possible. Now, that means that you won't be getting any benefits from the workers' compensation insurance company, but you can sue the employer in tort, and that may or may not work out well for you because the employer may or may not have any money. Third bullet addresses the problem of third-party intentional torts. It all depends on the nature of the dispute or the purpose of the tortfeasor. Thus, the fourth bullet, there's an exclusion for an intentional tort that was personal to the employee, in other words, arising out of the employee's own personal disputes, and that was not directed at him as an employee or because of his work. In other words, the man who came in the convenience store didn't shoot the employee because he was the cashier who had all the money. He shot him because it was revenge for last night's poker game. Now, in the Porter case, that all means that we have to decide whether or not Grandma was motivated by her personal dispute with Porter, or whether Porter suffered this assault simply because he happened to be an employee of the school. And we'll start at this point when we come back here on Thursday. We'll also pick up with this very last slide, which asks you to consider not only the Porter case, but other intentional tort scenarios, which are variations of Porter. So be prepared to discuss these five different hypotheticals when we return to class on Thursday. And that's all for this lecture.